Do we want to get rocked?
Today, the Podicle crew is in Southwest London to meet renowned record producer, engineer, songwriter, composer, and musician, Pete Woodruff. Our conversation with Pete, who has worked with many major artists, including a 14-year stint with Def Leppard, but tries to cram a 30-year career into just over 1 hour. Impossible, right? Well, along the way, we cover his early career, his time with Def Leppard, and we hear how Pete, after years of engineering and production work, reinvented himself as a songwriter and lyricist. But it's not all chat here either. There is some great music in here as well. We hope you enjoy it.
Why don't we do my resume of what happened? I love music. I went to university, did a proper degree in engineering and machine tools and factories. Got that by the time I was 21. Sat around doing nothing for about 2 months, and my dad said, there's a friend of mine who owns a factory up in Kettering, make widgets. You should probably go and work there. So I then went to the library and looked up in the yellow pages, long before the internet, all the studios in London that I'd heard of, and rang them up and said, can I come and get a job as a T-boy? And I wrote to three producers, and one of those was Andy Hill, who was the guy who at the time had done Bucks Fizz and was like, he was in the face. There was a thing of Andy Hill and Trevor Horn, these two great producers. Wrote to Trevor Horn as well, wrote to Tony Visconti. Dear Mr. Visconti. Anyway, the first person who got back was Andy, and he'd walked into his office one morning and said, right, I've got a house in the country, got a studio, I need someone to work there for nothing. And his assistant picked up a bit of paper and said, what about this bloke? And I'd just written saying, dear Sandy, or dear Andy, I'd like to work for you for nothing. Anyway, so got a job as a tape op for Bucks Fizz. That was my starting point. And as we just discussed, the day I arrived, Andy bought a few bits of kit, like a Fairlight and a few keyboards. And so I was tossed the manual, like, you're clever, work it out. So that was instantly, I was doing Fairlight programming, and that was great, as well as the tea. Still did the tea.
How long did you work there for?
5 years.
Unpaid?
No, it wasn't unpaid. I was unpaid. I was paid 60 quid a week, so a fair amount. But I had board and lodging, which was okay. And Andy was great. He's a genius. He wrote the Bucks Fizz stuff. Then he'd signed a publishing deal where he got a massive advance. And he said, I'm really never going to earn this back. So I'm just going to go and do some gardening. So he went up and did the gardening, and we had the studio we were working at, and it was great. And during the gardening, he bought a Mac, and he'd sit up in the sheds fiddling around with this Mac and trying a bit of writing. And, you know, he'd had three massive number ones with Bucks Fizz, and they were great records, really exciting records. He wrote Think Twice, that Celine Dion cut, that had 28 million album sales and was a hit all over the world. So he really was quite talented, that Mr. Hill. But I've always liked hit. I'm not a cool person at all. I like hit records and hit songs. You know, when I was a kid, I liked Ichigo Park by the Small Faces.
Over bridge of sights, to rest my eyes in shades of green, under dreaming spires, to Ichigo Park, that's where I've been.
What did you do there? What did you feel there?
Well, I cried.
But why the tears there?
Tell you why. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful.
I liked 10cc. I liked, you know, Yellow Brick Road and Bowie, and just records, great sounding records and hit songs. And I'm still like that, really. Albums. So Andy did really well. So I spent 5 years there. By the end of that 5 years, he'd invested lots of money in the studio, and it was an SSL desk and had loads of keyboards and drum machines and stuff that was all in the control room the whole time. We worked really hard. I had 5 days off 1 year. It was good though.
Producing all different.
No, I was just assisting and then engineering. And we had loads of people in, Jerry Rafferty, the Cutting Crew, Bee Gees, loads of people, and it was just a laugh. We had loads of other people who never really cracked it, but it was a really good training ground. Brian Tench, who engineered Hounds of Love, mixed the Hounds of Love for Kate Bush, and who produced the Bee Gees, and who did loads of Visage and loads of bands.
Where was the studio?
Lingfield in Surrey, hidden away in the middle of nowhere. I remember once coming out, having had no sleep for a week or something, standing there stroking the white cat, the long-haired white cat that Andy owned, and I'm standing looking rather dazed, you know, emerging from this no-light studio, and these two people came up the drive and they said, "Excuse me, do Bucks Fizz live here?" I was like, "No." It was, yeah, it's good though. So anyway, so I eventually was going mad. I kind of just didn't go.
I'm surprised that you weren't sleeping for a whole week.
No, my bedroom was above the studio as well. It was.
And
not...
you obviously had a good studio tan as well. As
yes,
you called it in those days.
So I left and I went freelance, which was a stupid move because everyone I worked with was managed by the studio. When I left, it was like no clients, and I sat at home for 3 weeks. But a guy had come in who was German, who'd spent 2 weeks at the studio doing English versions of songs, and we got on really well. And they'd sort of said, right, okay, we're doing it. They'd redone versions of songs, and they said, we need a bass that goes dung 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 dung. And I'd just sit at the back of the controller and program it on a Lin 9000, I think we had then. And it was all synced up, so I'd just walk around, put the faders up and go like this, and they go, yeah, they're great. So we got on really well, and his band really nice. And after the 3 weeks of sitting at home going, what am I going to do? He rang up and said, come and work on my new album. I said, yeah, but you have your own engineer, and you know I can't really just continue assisting. I've got to do engineering. And he said, no, engineer my next record. So I said, wow, okay, well, look, I'll send you a tape, a CD or cassette or something of my work, because you've never heard my work. I've only ever made tea for you. He said, ah, it'll be fine. You make very good tea. And that's how I got the gig.
Brilliant.
So that was, suddenly I had kind of a year's work. I went off and worked in Belgium recording this album, and it was a guy called Herbert Grönemeyer, who's huge in Germany, and it was a laugh. It was great.
Sein Pyjama liegt in meinem Bett, sein Kamm in meiner Bürste steckt. Was soll das? Was soll das? Seine Schuhe stehen in Reih und Glied, der Anblick, den man gerne sieht. Was soll das? Was soll das? Sein Aftershave klebt in der Luft, warum hat er nicht gleich meins benutzt? Was soll das? Womit hab ich das verdient?
Put a studio into a house, which at the time no one did, and made the record. And it was very successful. He'd done one massive album called Bochum, and the second album had kind of sold half as many. So the label, everyone kind of thought, that's going nowhere. He's just an actor who does it. He was in Das Boot, and they all thought it was all over. So he did this album, and it did really well. And he's still huge in Germany, and he's a lovely chap.
In time-honored tradition, did you have a producer credit on that?
No, I was just
engineering from it.
No. I was just.
See, this is the thing that people probably don't understand. The producer would get a percentage, but the engineer just gets paid a wage.
Yeah. And because so after that, in my last couple of months at the studio, Andy Hill Studio, Comfort's Place, I'd a guy come in called Mike Shipley who was mixing a track, and I was a huge fan of Prefab Sprout's album Steve McQueen and Thomas Dolby's album The Flat Earth, and he'd mixed both of them, and I was like, Mike, you're amazing, you know, like, and we just chatted. He spent 2 days mixing, and in those days you had to rewind the tape between songs. Nowadays you don't have to, so there's that sort of 1 minute where you could play something and check this out, and we just got on really well and like very similar music. So when I left, I also got in touch with him and said, I'd love to work with you. You know, you're an engineer who's mixing and who's producing. So he produced a couple of things by then, and The Cars, he'd done Tonight She Comes on their greatest hits album, and he produced Joni Mitchell, Dog Eat Dog. So I said, if you need an engineer, someone who can program, give me a shout. And that eventually led to me working on this Def Leppard album. And he'd said, look, Hysteria that they'd already done was massive, and this follow-up album, he said, it'll be 6 months, we'll all come up smelling of roses, you know, we've got a few songs kicking around already, it'll be fine. And because everyone had known that Hysteria took 3 years, and it's like, whoa. You know, you'd meet people who'd come back from Dublin, and you'd say, what's going on in Dublin? They say, oh, Def Leppard's still working on their record, and we'd all fall about laughing, you know. But it did sell 20 million albums, so it did okay. Anyway, so then the one I worked on, Adrenalize, was meant to be quick, and that took 3.5 years. Steve Clark died, but Mike produced it. That was a long haul. Okay, this is before my time with Def Leppard, but the band were working at Vistalord Studios on Hysteria, and Pyromania had been huge, but Hysteria was costing, you know, they'd spent years on this record. And Joe should tell the story. Joe's a very funny and lovely guy. So the singer, Joe, is sitting outside Vistalord on the step, lovely woodland, it's sort of pine forest around the studio, and he's next to the Jaco Pastorius band, who happened to be in studio whatever at the same time. Sav, the bass player, they were still young at this time, appeared in a red Porsche driving up towards the studio and kind of slightly stalling and, you know, finally gets into the parking place. And one of the brilliant jazz musicians says, it seems like the less music you know, the more money you earn. And Joe said, yes, I only know 3 chords and I'm a millionaire. He said, of course, he was actually about 2 million in debt at the time because they haven't got so much money. In fact, the first time I ever met Mutt Lange, who is a legend, and if your listeners don't know, he produced AC/DC, Back in Black, he produced The Cars, Heartbeat City, he produced Def Leppard, he then produced Bryan Adams, his massive stuff, he produced and married Shania Twain and then left Shania Twain. Anyway, so he's a utter genius. Bob Lefsetz, the guy in America, the lawyer who does a podcast, yeah. He says Mutt has the best hit to shit ratio of anyone in the business. He's amazing. So the first time I met him, I'm obviously a youngish recording engineer in awe, and there's the band and they're talking to him and they're talking about how they were planning to build studios at home and hopefully bring the budgets down because the Hysteria had cost millions and because they had to have an SSL studio the whole time. And Mutt said, yeah, you know, I think nowadays, you know, recording can be much, much cheaper, but, you know, mixing's always going to be expensive. And at that point, I couldn't stop myself. I have this terrible joke Tourette's. I said, mixing always expensive, not the way I do it. Yeah, never worked with me again. Weird.
Was that the last time you spoke to him? Or he spoke to you?
Not at all. He ended up, actually, on Euphoria, Mutt came over, and we had a fantastic week. Where we worked, there was two songs, one called All Night and another one called Promises that he worked on. Promises actually we'd sent him the backing track and he worked on the melody and lyric. It was great. Anyway, he came over and we had a week. One day the band all, they had their personal trainer over to get them all buff for the videos. And so it's just me and Mutt in the studio. And I said, okay, Mutt, I want to play you the songs you're not working on just for some tips. And he sat there with a dictaphone and just each song said, you know, and it was just a masterclass in how you make songs great.
lot of time wasted in the studio.
No. The whole of the Adrenalize, we got in the studio at 10 o'clock in the morning. We worked 6 days a week till midnight, every single day. We worked like insanely all the whole way through the album. We had a 6 month break where I went off to Australia with Phil to do a BB Steel album. But apart from that, it was full on the whole time.
Over what period of time?
3.5 years. So 3 years of actual work, yeah. 6 days a week. We'd have Saturdays off.
For one album?
One album. 45 minutes of
music. 10 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night.
And all the songs, 6 days a week. All the songs were written except for one.
Before you started?
Yeah, the demos had been done before then.
Holy mackerel. What took the time?
We would spend 2 weeks on a rhythm guitar. So it'd be like, that you'd plug it in and go, yeah, sounds all right. And then you'd EQ it. And we'd have, I still probably have files upstairs. Every guitar sound I'd log so that we could come back to a guitar sound. So it would be, you know, going into the AMEC mic preamp and then to the SSL EQ and then the URI notch filter and all the settings, the Clark Technic graphic equalizer, even down to if the guitar buzzed, you'd have a crocodile clip on the scratch plate attached to a piece of outboard gear. So all of this was drawn out. I probably have them upstairs, I'll show you. And so you'd get a good guitar sound and just then getting it in time. Jing, 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 jing. You know, it was excruciatingly painful.
It must have taken you half that time just to make all these notes.
Well, that was my own personal hell. We had, and also, you know, there was no Pro Tools, so we would sample the guitars. I think when you start to put something under the microscope, when you really start to zone in, so you've got the drums, Rick would play everything, but on pads, so then suddenly that's on a computer, so it can be programmed. So you've got it quantized, you then do the bass to that, and it's absolutely nailed. And then you do the guitars. It's not like when you have a real drummer. Sometimes when you mix something that's real, you put the drums up and you go, whoa, this is all a bit... But with this, when you're doing... And then you've got hundreds of tracks of backing vocals. You have the lead vocal sound of Hysteria that Joe had created. You know, it's amazing. It's an amazing sounding record. And so we were with Adrenalize following that up. So it was incredibly hard work. I remember locking myself in a room in Dublin and just crying 2 years into the album. Because I thought, 2 years? And at no point on the album did you think it was going to take more than another 6 weeks to finish. Obviously, it's going to be done. We'll be mixing soon. But it just kept going on and on and on. And it was...
Because I mean, two things. I mean, I get that a lot of bands were under pressure to produce an album every year. And I mean, there's the famous story of Roddy Frame of Aztec Camera. They wanted the follow-up to the first album and pushed him into a studio in Wales. And he didn't have a song to his name to even record. And all the studio time had been booked. The point you raise about having to make notes as an engineer producer of how you created a sound is critical. And I don't know how many engineers and producers actually do that, because you hear stories of bands who got a phenomenal sound on one particular album and they were never able to replicate it. And that strikes me as either because they were using a different studio or different equipment came along, or they were using different equipment, or they just failed to note what it's, settings they had on all the various
and even tiny and, things like the strings on a guitar, the batteries in the compressor pedal, all those things. There was a lovely moment. Phil had bought a Bradshaw rack, which was the bee's knees thing from LA. It was 15 grand, and it was a double width studio rack thing with guitar preamps, effects pedals, and power amp, everything you need for guitar sound, and a massive switching thing, like a pedal board, which was quite primitive, but you could basically set it up so that every song you could change your sound for each section for live. And we had this in the studio, and we tried it, and it just didn't quite sound right. So we were working on a track, and someone said, oh man, Extreme are in town, they're playing in Dublin, and they're going to come up to the house. Fantastic, great, Nuno Bettencourt, genius. And obviously Extreme had just done their first album, Porno Graffiti, was it? And it was amazing. So they came up to the studio, and as they were approaching outside, just coming to the door, Phil went, Pete. So I had to kick the thing we were using, which actually was a Rockman Ace that cost 50 quid, under the rack, because the rack wasn't actually being used at all, it was on. We were just using this little 50 quid Rockman and then going through racks of outboard gear to make it sound good, because the Rockman had, its distortion didn't have that fuzziness which a Marshall would have. The Marshall's going, which is fine, but if you have 24 tracks of guitar, well, more, in the chorus. So many different parts happening, so root notes and then jangles and counterparts and chords. It just sounds all fuzzy the moment you track it up. But with a Rockman, it sounded clean. And so we were using the Rockman. And of course, the moment the guys walked in, Nuno Bettencourt goes, "Oh my God, you got the Bradshaw rack. Amazing. How does it sound?" It's like, really good. Yeah. Anyway, so that album, yeah, it was really hard work. There was no partying. There was no fun. Adrenalize was following up Hysteria that had been massive. Massive. You know, in the UK, it was quite hard to see how massive. But they'd had the number one song on MTV 2 years in a row with the same song. They'd sold, in 1 year, it grossed $80 million, one record. And that was just 1 year. You know, it was big beyond that. Had six hit singles, I think. It was really amazing and huge and fantastic. So there is a kind of unease to following that up. And Mutt wasn't working on it. He'd written the songs with the band, but he wasn't producing it. He was off doing Bryan Adams. So there was a slight feeling of second guessing what would Mutt do.
Were they well-behaved boys, though? I mean, yeah, they're obviously very disciplined in the studio.
Yeah, we would normally work with one of them, or normally Sav, the bass player, and Phil or Viv, or, you know, the drums, because the drums are either done at the beginning or the end. There was 1 year we said, "Oh, we should send Rick a fax saying happy birthday." Back in the day of faxes, so we wrote this thing saying happy birthday, and we thought, actually, we haven't seen him since his last birthday, so we wrote him two.
Seriously?
Yeah. On Adrenalize, we're mixing it. And I was sitting there beside Mike Shipley, and we had all these Akai's running live at the mix. As we were sitting there doing the mix at Skip Sailors in Los Angeles, Mike says, "Pete, how old are you?" And I go, I'm 30. And he goes, 30? I thought you were 27. I said, "Well, what was the last time you asked on the album?" Anyway, but we were mixing. Okay, we were mixing at the studio Skip Sailors, and we had two Mitsubishi 32 tracks. And we had the code running to, I think, two computers that were running the drums, you know, it's all played but triggering sounds because he only has one arm and it's pads. So they're all running live. So it's a big old thing going on. And we'd mixed the first single, which is Let's Get Rocked. That went back to England and had been mastered by Bob Ludwig. And then Mutt appeared. So Mutt was there for the rest of the mixing. And Mutt said, "Oh, we should have another crack at Let's Get Rocked, man. I think it could be better." So we're working on that, doing the mix of that. And the record company, of course, are going, "Really? It's been 3.5 years since you started the record." So they really wanted the single out. They had the deadlines and said, "You know, we want this." And so we're getting there with the mix. And they said, "Don't worry, it'll be done. We're going to get it done tonight. And the bike is going to come from LAX and going to take the tape, fly to Portland, Maine, where Bob Ludwig will master it tonight and then tomorrow morning or whatever, and then it'll be fine. It's all going to be cool." So we're working away on this, and the phone rings. So Mike stops the tape. Record company, "No, it's fine. It'll be done. He's 20 minutes away. Yeah, it'll be done by then. We'll take it now. Okay, bye." Puts the phone down, presses play, and a mosquito had landed on the tape of one of the two multi-tracks. And as Mike hit play, it went, and its little life disappeared. We're like, "Oh, oops." Rewound the tape, press play again, and the middle section of the song, all the backing vocals has dropped out because with digital, it's a control track. And so we had 1.5 seconds of silence. And at that point, everyone in the room looked at me and said, "Got a safety copy?" And I went, "Yeah." Thinking, "Oh, yeah." How recently did I back it up? And we did have a safety copy, and we did the mix, and it was anything that could go wrong on that album did. When we first went to Dublin, we'd set up in he moved to a new house. He said, "I'll build the studio first, and you can, sorry for the terrible Yorkshire accent, build the studio first, and then the house will be done around it, but the studio will be done first." So get the studio done. We buy the band instead of, you know, we knew it was going to take a while, so we bought them to buy a Mitsubishi multitrack that cost 80 grand, a lot of money. Guy comes over from England, flies in, sets it all up, polishes all the cards, does whatever he does, and we're like, "Ah, oh, thanks, man, fantastic." And off he goes. And we start working. And the second day, we'd done the first bunch of guitars, put the drums down, and the second day we come in, and there's the guys, the builders, are standing there looking really shifty. And we say, "All right?" And they go, "Would there be a problem if a drop of water went into that?" Drop of water, and there'd been a flood upstairs, and the halogen downlighter above that happened to be where the water. And so we opened the two doors of the Mitsubishi that had been left on all night, of course, because you leave it on because you, yeah. And all the cars at the bottom right were just charred and burnt out. So we had to ring up England, and the guy flew out and he's like, "Def Leppard, right?" Because anything that could go wrong did go wrong. We then had power problems. So this could be a whole interview about Adrenalize. It was unbelievable. So we're working away on this on a track, and by now we've got 20 tracks of guitars, you know, seriously massive guitar arrangements, and Phil's there playing his parts and doing jangles, and then let's try this. And suddenly, the power cut. Oh, okay. So we turn the tape machine off quickly, and we wait, have, you know, 20 minutes later, the power comes back on. Right, we've got to sort this out. Play the tape. Knackered, we have to start again, because again, this one control track, if you're in record on any track at the time of the power cut, the control track is also being recorded and you lose all the data, so it's start again. So I ring up the Irish electricity board and say, "Guys, this is a terrible problem. We're here, and Joe's uncle is on an artificial lung, and if you turn the power off, he's going to die. Okay, so please, if you're going to turn the power off, call us. And we can sort it out. It'll be fine. We can put him on a, you know, it'll be okay. But please call us or he'll die." Right? Okay? Fine. Off we go. Carry on working. Week later, power goes off. And we're like, "What?" And the phone rings. "Hello? Is he all right?" "No, he's dead." Anyway, so then we got a battery for the studio, for the control room. And it cost, again, lots of money. And it's, you know, big old power supply thing. Mm. So the whole studio was plugged into the battery. Not the rest of the house, but the studio. And we're working away. And, you know, there we're cool. We've got a battery. We're not going to be any power cuts. We're sorted. Working away. And suddenly, instead of it going off, suddenly we heard grinds to a halt. Lights go out. What the heck? Well, there'd been a power cut half an hour previously. The batteries lasted half an hour and they'd gone flat. What? So then we had a flashing light put in. So when the power cut out, the flashing light would flash. And then we were fine for the next. But that was like, that's why it took so long. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong. We went to LA and the guitar sounds that we'd spent, you know, written down every setting. Mics, there's a thing on a digital multitrack called a rehearse button. And if you press the rehearse button, when you drop into record, it doesn't record, it just switches to input. So, for instance, if you wanted to get the sound of someone singing, matching up with the one on tape, you could go, "Hello," and switch to "Hello," hit it off tape and compare. Well, we were doing this with the guitars, and I said, "Oh, Mike, should we check that rehearse button works?" And he said, "Of course it works." Anyway. So we went through, and he dropped in and out to compare the guitar sound with all the settings and the stuff we'd done. And it didn't work, and he'd erased the guitar that we'd spent.
No.
Yeah, again, luckily we had a safety copy. When we went to America, we were worried that the tapes would be stopped at customs, and they'd go, "Hold on a second. Wait a minute, these tapes, this is Def Leppard. This could be worth millions." So we thought, "Oh, that's a bad idea. If we're going to go to America, we should probably relabel all the tapes." So all the multitracks and all the track sheets, I relabeled as a completely new band called Stormbringer. And Stormbringer, instead of it being Joe, Steve, Phil, you know, and Rick, it was Dave, Gary, Barry, and all the names corresponded. So every track sheet was Barry, was, and then every song title was different. So Let's Get Rocked became There's a Party in Your Mouth and We're All Coming. Have You Ever became I'm Coming Home. So the whole album, and that took 2 days just to do all the track sheets and stuff for that.
Good grief. I had no idea how much administration was involved.
A question for, I would have said for anyone who's listening, really, but I mean, you just said to me that you record every single thing, every instrument, every piece separately.
Yeah.
When does the band get together to play the whole piece then?
when they do their pop concerts. Your Majesty.
So purely only in the case of live, or they're rehearsing
but it's,
for the live
Def
show.
Def Leppard were very produced records. There was a lovely interview with Thomas Dolby at about when they were talking about how much CDs cost. It's outrageous, $9.99, whatever it was for a compact disc. And he was on this radio phone-in, and he was being asked, you know, do you think music is value for money? And he said, well, he said, frankly, if it's a band like Def Leppard, then yes, it is value for money because they spend so long making these records. And they're really, you know, you look back, and I know Adrenalize and Hysteria, I didn't work in Hysteria, it's amazing. You know, they're incredible records. They're of their time. But you listen to Hysteria, it's a phenomenal record. Just, you know, animal. Listen to the up to the first chorus, and I think every guitar in there has been taken off and put back. It's the feel is nailed. It's just amazing. And the vocals, the backing vocals, the lead vocals, incredible performances. But it just takes a long time.
Try.